All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, first and foremost, thank you guys so much for checking out this episode of the Big MX Radio podcast. I hope you guys enjoy it. And if you do, I hope that you let me know either on social media, maybe share it on your story. That's always appreciated. And support the companies that support the show. That's what keeps this whole thing going. That's what allows me to do this as a full-time gig. Racetech Suspension, if you mention Big MX Radio, you're going to save some money at your favorite Racetech Service Center, as well as when you're ordering from their headquarters in California. All of these guys, all the sponsors are hugely, hugely important. WUSA, they offer a discount to anybody who mentions Big MX Radio while you're making your purchase. Big MX 20 also saves you at Guts Racing. Big MX 20 is going to save you 20%. Big MX 24 is going to save 24% off at Backyard Design. So basically 25% off of your entire order right off the hop. I absolutely love it. And actually, Big MX will also save you, I believe it's 40%, if I'm not mistaken, with the Slacker digital seg scale. Like, if you want to set the seg on your bike, maybe you're neglecting it, maybe you don't have the tools, maybe you're just too lazy. Nobody is too lazy for the Slacker. It is so, so easy. You can do it in just a matter of moments and get it done. You can save yourself some money with Big MX at checkout. I appreciate those guys. Heartbeat Hot Sauce, now available at Costco as well as Amazon. And that's Costco both north and south of the border, mind you. So we're super stoked on that. Luxon MX, Big MX 2024 is how to save 10% off any purchase. Now, if it was, say, a set of their bar mounts, I think those things run at about $100, so you're going to save $10. But if it happens to be a set of triple clamps, well, you're going to save yourself $100 off of your purchase price. And you're going to get some awesome clamps that are super adjustable. They look super trick. And if they're good enough for Phil Nicoletti, heck, they're good enough for you. So thanks, everyone, so much for taking the time to listen to this episode. I really appreciate you guys. If you guys happen to need any engine work done, or if you happen to be in the Colorado, sort of northern Texas area, and you want to dial up Money Inc., I highly recommend doing so. I know they're super busy right now, but I'm sure they'll be able to fit you guys in. As always, thanks for listening, guys, and yeah, let's get on with the show. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Big MX Radio Podcast. I am your host, Brad Gebhardt. With me on the line, a good friend of mine, and an absolute badass when it comes to riding dirt bikes, no matter where it is, whether he's leading kids around at Loretta Lynn's or leading laps and doing quite well in not only the Grand National, the GNCC Championship, but also the National Enduro Championship, where he is a champion. Goes by the name of Stuart Baylor. Stu, how's it going?
Good. Just another week doing my thing. Sitting behind the wheel and driving to Missouri, headed to another national tour.
Well, and so the listeners will have to put up with a little bit of road noise as, yeah, you are barreling down the highway, heading off to Missouri. Take us through your season a little bit so far, man. There's been some ups, there's been some downs, there's been some laps led, and seems like probably maybe more frustration on the racing side than you're typically used to. How do you handle that kind of adversity?
It's been a bit difficult. Like, I'd be lying if I said it was easy to juggle all that I put on my plate. But at this point, like, you know, all things considered, it's been a really good year. Sitting second pretty comfortably in both series is definitely not, you know, not an easy task. But at the same time, I've got that thought lingering in the back of my mind, like, what if I focus more on my racing and less on the team aspects a little bit? And, you know, obviously that's definitely a thought that still crossed my mind. I definitely at this point feel like the team is good and growing, and not that I would ever want to turn back on my team, but trying to put together a new guy in a good position to manage this thing so that I can get back to focusing on racing and do what I need to do for the next few years of my career.
Certainly. So, yeah, like we've talked in previously, bringing in Rachel Archer. She's got the number one plate and a points lead. She's doing quite well in her championship series. Same thing with Caleb Wood. What can you tell me about Olin Daniels and a couple of the others that you've sort of added to the team, rounding out the entire lineup?
Yeah, I mean, Olin's come a long way. He's had some good races. Last race didn't fare him so well, but he's had better results up until then than he has the rest of the year. He's slowly progressed. And coming from New England, where you look at Johnny Girard, Josh Toth, Ben Kelly, the guys that have come out of there in recent years, they've taken a few years to get adapted, but once they did, I think their riding style and their skill set they learned riding the technical terrain in New England, it transfers very well to the GNCCs. I'm looking to see bright things out of him in the future, and man, GNCC is just a different beast entirely. I feel like for us versus other forms of racing dirt bikes, there is a major advantage to guys that are veterans in that series or guys that grew up racing that series, and it takes at least 2 years, but sometimes more like three, before you really start to find yourself in a groove there at the GNCC. So, Olin's done very well, and behind him, Will Stephen Piper as well. He's doing extremely well at the National Enduros. Almost won the last two National Enduros, won some tests, beat quite a few guys. I think got a top five overall, maybe fourth overall in a section. So Will's done very well at the National Enduro side. GNCCs, he's right there on that podium mark of the amateur class and bouncing around top 20 overall. So he's doing well as well. But it's good to see my guys doing well. It's good to see Rachel doing well. Caleb should hopefully, if all goes well, wrap up his championship in the youth class for another youth overall championship, and we'll be moving him up to the big bike for the remaining two rounds of GNCC if he can win this next one. So, as far as things go, it's good. It can be better, and I can promise one thing, it will be much better next year. We have some really big names on the roster as far as new riders that we signed for next season, as well as a new team manager that we signed for next year. And things are shaping up quite well. We've had some hiccups along the way, and a lot of still boiling over into what I call the second half of the season. So, GNCC has a summer break, and traditionally we go back to racing in September. This year it moved up just a little bit earlier than normal with the ISP interrupting things, but so we're already back to racing with GNCC. Still don't have everything lined up as far as sponsors, companies, title sponsor spots, little things that we're still trying to tie up loose ends there. As a racer, to have that on your plate and know, like, hey, you've got to come up with this money or you're not going to be able to pay all your mechanics. It's tough to sleep at night knowing that I've still got a lot of work to do to get this team rolling for next year. But, all in all, it's definitely shaping up to be great.
Certainly. So, in that respect, when you talk about Caleb, he's obviously been very successful, looking to wrap up a championship. If he is successful in doing so, for the last two rounds, will he end up in 250B, 250A, or will he join Thad Duval in XC2?
So, most likely, we're going to try to put him in 250A class or the Porsche Bay Likes class, see how he does against those guys. And I think a little bit depends on motocross and what class he can drop back to, essentially, in motocross. If he can run the A class here and still race a super mini at Minios, but not sure on those little details. That stuff we just have to work on right now to try to get those details worked out. But as it stands, the 250A Likes would be the class we try to shift him to after the youth thing.
Right, and so for those who don't know, Caleb does spend a good amount of time on the 250. In fact, I saw him practicing on one 9 months ago at the New Year's. So he spent quite a bit of time on the bike. He'll adapt to it quite well, I think.
Yeah. I mean, as it stands, he's already faster on the big bike. He hates being on the little bike. He's definitely ready to make that change, and he's a lot smoother. You know, when you watch Caleb ride, like he's a pretty precise rider, and it transfers better to the big bike than the little bike, where, you know, on that Super Mini on the two strokes, you gotta hold it wide open and bang the clutch, and that's not necessarily what Caleb likes to ride. So I think he'll be a much better big bike rider than even he was in the little bike.
Fair enough. What is it that you guys work on the most week to week, even for yourself? Like, there's always room for improvement. There are always the different skills to sharpen down at the Shoals, which is another piece that sits on your plate on a weekly basis.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's a little bit different now based on what it took to get to where I am. So now it's honestly, lately, it's been just trying to get enough seat time in general, just trying to find the time to actually get on my dirt bike and go ride and not have to clean up somebody else's mess or make a call for somebody who can't, or try to figure out who's screwed what up on what week. But yeah, I mean, overall, it's definitely, like, as it stands, it's like just trying to get back on the motorcycle for me. And again, that's one of the big reasons I feel that I need a manager. I mean, I'm sitting so well in points and, you know, doing it with a lot less time on the bike than normal, and definitely a lot less help than I need. So, yeah, I mean, overall, it's reminders at this point when I do ride. It's little things, make sure that I'm re-gripping, make sure I'm trying to turn my toes in, just sharpen things. I don't have a picture perfect riding style. I've had quite a few injuries that make me to where my joints don't move like they should, my hands don't move like they should. So some of my riding style is what it is at this point. I'm an old dog. You can't teach me new tricks, but I can work on little things, you know, riding more with my feet on the pegs, and you know, that's the stuff that I try to focus on, just little things. Bike setup, I spend quite a bit, you know, with a screwdriver, changing settings, just trying to chase that dream setting. And you know, that's more what I focus on through my weeks. But as far as our other guys, there's so much. It's really just repetition, and each rider, it is an individual. I mean, there's some guys that they got perfect posture, but they have no aggression. There's other guys who, watching them, they ride very flawlessly. And in most cases, I don't like my guys to use their clutch much at all. But with that said, like, your clutch is a tool. So learning how to use it and when to use it is good. Like I say, as far as that goes, it's really tailored to the group. And the last couple of weeks, it's been the motto that I've been hearing Steven use a lot is trying to get these guys comfortable when they're uncomfortable. So he's been running a track that he waters half of it pretty heavily, the other part basically looking to try to get the corners really good, perfect race conditions, and the rest of it he leaves completely ball dry. And you're getting a bunch of different conditions throughout that single minute and 45 second lap time, and you're practicing getting comfortable where there is a lack of comfort. You know, you come out of one corner and the traction's perfect, and you dive into the next one and the bike's all over the place because it's sloppy, muddy, slippery, whatever, and the next one's going to be a silt berm. So I know that's kind of been the focus here lately. Just now, talking to Steven, it seemed like he was under the impression that I made my guys too soft by giving them perfect conditions every day. And I'm gonna sit here and not argue a bit with him, because I've seen my guys that normally would complain about riding those bad conditions, and they're doing it with a smile on their face. So you know, and it seems to be working.
No doubt. So let's talk a little bit more about Stephen Squire, someone that you've sort of brought into the fray over the last month or so, and it seems like these two of you guys get along amazingly well. And like, I think that must have been a little bit of a gut check for you as someone who definitely prides himself on being a hard-nosed guy. For having a new person roll in and sort of just tell you straight up, hey, you're making people soft, and that is in no way your intention. And it's good to hear that you were sort of perceptive to that and were able to pivot and make a change.
Yeah, I mean, Steven's good. He knows what he's doing. Steven and I actually did riding schools together, training kids. God, 12, 13 years ago at this point, back before either of us had started facilities. And then he kind of started and ran a facility. Things went sideways, and he ended up getting out of dirt bike racing for a brief period, and it didn't sound like he had any interest. And, you know, I brought it up about him coming down here and working for me, and he was kind of burnt by dirt bikes at that point. Just a few months ago, absolutely. And just a few months ago, he realized that as burnt as he was, he's still sick and twisted in the head and loves dirt bikes more than anything. And I called him about working and just building a motocross track. We were finishing up that Loretta's pad, and I was running low on time, and I knew I needed somebody else to come in here and knock it out. And I called him for that, and one thing led to another, and I was like, man, it's at least worth asking the question again. And my aunt, Tracy Wood, you know, Caleb Wood's mom, she was like, hey, just, I mean, what's the worst thing to say? No. And I'm like, well, he's already told me no once, so I'll see what he says. And I didn't really have high hopes, and he's like, let me call Whitney. He calls his wife. He calls me back 5 minutes later. He's like, all right, I'm in. And it was basically as simple as that. And things started to proceed. And, you know, for me, I genuinely, and we've had this conversation so many times, as a business owner, you want somebody that will run your business and run you if need be. In a lot of cases, like I've had so many times where, yeah, it sucks to have somebody that thinks that they control you or control the place. They get too controlling. I don't need somebody that's controlling. I need somebody who runs it as if it was theirs. And Steve has done exactly that. You know, he comes in with a different perspective, and he's running it as if it's his. And he's, you know, hey, this is what I see. And I know that it hasn't been perfect. So in that, you know, in that aspect, it's easy for me to stand back and say, okay, well, let's see you do it. You know, let's see what happens. If 6 months go by and I start getting complaints that, hey, we don't want the track to be like this anymore, then I talk to Steven and say, hey, let's adjust. But at this point, it's his. I want to let him kind of run with it. And you know, obviously I'm still there. I still answering the phone a bit and making sure that things go on. But yeah, right now it's trying to make sure that he has the tools that he needs to do his job and see what he can do with it. And so far he's done really well.
That's awesome. Sounds like it's a good marriage and will continue to be one. Your goals for the remainder of the GNCC and the National Enduro Championship, like you said, it's been challenging. But how do you finish off the season with your best foot forward and make sure that everyone knows rolling into 2025 that you're going to be someone to reckon with? And I guess furthermore, how do you put sort of stop the sort of the rolling tank that is Johnny Girard? The guy has been pretty lights out all season.
Yeah, he's been riding phenomenal. I mean, at this point, he's essentially got the championship in the bag. It is what it is. I'm not happy with second, but I've got to settle for it at this point. But you know, all I can do is try to win. Try to win every time I line up, and hopefully, you know, the weaknesses that I've had this year, I can work out and fix for next year. And you know, we're already starting to work on some of those things, like just getting the bike starting a little bit faster, trying to find some tips and tricks to to do that, making sure that the mechanical issues don't continue. We've just had, man, just small things missed. And, you know, obviously we've had a very good year and been very fortunate with bike failures, et cetera. But, you know, there's a difference in lining up every week, knowing 100% without a doubt that every I is dotted and T is crossed, versus lining up and kind of second guessing little things. And, you know, little things being slightly off. As much as it doesn't matter at a normal pro level, even, there's a big difference in a championship pro level versus just a pro level. And, you know, I feel like I'm in that championship level and have been for quite some time. And yeah, just the last few years, I've struggled with little mistakes. And, you know, my goal is to eliminate those with my team. And obviously, if I can eliminate those with my team, I'll be eliminating those issues for myself as well. And, you know, just trying to chase perfection is the goal right now. More than results, more than anything else, try to chase perfection on the weekend, making sure that bike is set up right, and it's starting good, and all of the little details and nothing's missed.
Fair enough. So from a team manager standpoint, or from a team operator standpoint, what can you do on race day to like sort of like right the ship, or at least make good on that statement that you want to be as perfect as possible? It comes down to preparation. It comes down to putting yourself in good positions. But it also comes down to having the people around you, like your wife, who's an amazing support system, having that all come together.
Yeah, I mean, it's to me, like, the things that are important are making sure that we have our team meetings, making sure that we eat together as a team. We do things as a team, because, as you know, racing is not a team sport. But it does take a team, or more or less a small army, to tackle these championships and off-road world, and or just in racing in general. And making sure that we have everybody on the same page is like the biggest thing for me as far as that goes. I can't put enough emphasis on like working together as a team, building that group, building that trust, building that relationship. And it's the small things, man. It's making sure that you show up for team dinners. It's making sure that you show up for team meetings. It's making sure that the team dinners and meetings are there and taking place, and that everybody's on the same page. And, you know, obviously, on the weekends, I'm still there to do my job. I'm still there to make sure all my goggles are done perfectly. I'm still there to make sure that I pedal that track as many times as I possibly can, and sign up and sign autographs and shake my bike down and make sure all of my racing stuff is done. But sadly, with the team, some of that kind of trumps what I have to do and what I have to focus on. And, you know, on Thursday, I get to the race and I start cooking, and I cook for 12 hours straight to make sure that the food is all prepared. To don't wave your hand like you cook. My wife's acting like she doesn't. She throws it on the grill after I prepare it. So,
Sliding the pizza isn't the oven in the oven isn't making pizza. Jade.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I try to make sure that all of that stuff's done, get the grocery shopping done, make sure that I get the whiteboard out to write the notes, make sure that I send it to the WhatsApp and the group that everybody's got a team meeting at what time it is. Yeah, I mean, those are the big details as far as the team goes that I have to make sure that I'm spot on with. And again, it does affect my racing, and I know it does. I'm not naive, and I know next year we've got an answer to it. I've got a great team manager that's going to take a lot of that off the plate. So it's just a matter of getting through the end of this year and eliminating the issues that we can, and go ahead and start building for next season.
Fair enough. Already having your eyes set on 2025. In addition to, obviously, the National Enduro Series and DNCC, what other types of events do you see yourself competing in the coming years? Like, would you like to do Loretta's? Would you like to do Minios? Do a little bit more motocross? Or is that off the table?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say. Like, given my time frame right now, it's been so difficult for me to even find time to play with my kid, much less take on any more racing.
Fair enough.
So, yes, I you know, short answer, yes, I'd love to do some of that stuff. Long answer is you know, making sure that I have the time on the schedule to be able to do those things. And, you know, a lot of those things I wish I would have done a couple of years ago. At this point, like, you know, my injuries have turned to arthritis. My ability to pick up new things is not what it was when I was 25. You know, as you get older, like in this sport, like, not saying that I've slowed down on the GNCC or enduro side, I definitely haven't, but that ability to make changes has definitely gone a little bit backwards. You know, to say, okay, let's go out and let's throw a lot of cross. Like, it takes a different style of training and a whole different routine. And I wish I had gone back and tried some of these things, you know, when I was young enough to adapt quickly. And I definitely want to try some more hard enduro at some point. I definitely want to try to go and do a Dakar or a Baja. Like, I feel like those events are something that I would regret if I didn't ever give it the opportunity or give myself the chance to do it. And, you know, earlier in my career, especially like when I was 25, I had these opportunities and I said no. As I get older, you kind of start realizing, like, man, that window of getting paid to go ride your dirt bike in random places throughout the country and world is closing. And, you know, you didn't take advantage of this. And you know, you turned down going to 6 days. You turned down this. You turned down that. Looking back, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of races. There's a lot of events that I wish I would have partaken in. And at this point, I regret a lot of those decisions to not go, but I definitely want to try. I want to try to do a little bit more motocross. I want to try to do some different fast races, like desert races. I just did my first one doing Vegas to Reno, and man, it was scary, but it was different. It wasn't. There was no money on the line. There was no purse I was after. I don't even know if they paid out. I, quite honestly, I didn't even check. Like, I went out to ride my dirt bike for the fun of it, and that's what we did. So, you know, I still enjoy riding my motorcycle, and, you know, I'd like to chase different events that remind me of that.
That's super cool. So when it comes to working with young athletes, which is something you still do quite a bit of, what are some of the most, like, sort of rewarding pieces within that? Like, being able to work with young athletes and have them sort of achieve that sort of aha moment where it starts to click and they understand what they need to do. Like, you're a grizzled old vet, but that's probably still got to be near and dear to your heart sometimes.
Yeah, you know, it's tough for guys to see the transition, and sometimes it's easy, and a lot of times the first week somebody's at the place, like, you get some of that instant gratification, but when you talk like a young athlete and more like along the lines of a Caleb Wood or a Christian Janik or somebody fast like that, like, there isn't much instant gratitude in anything that they do. Like, it's a process. It's slow, and it's a building process. And, you know, I had this conversation actually with Steven last night. Like, you can't take a weekend class of a foreign language and learn it. No different than you can't go to a weekend writing clinic and change what you've done for the last 10 years. You can't take Spanish for a year and remember it 5 years later. It just doesn't happen. I mean, genuinely, like, it takes years to learn a new language. And to me, riding a dirt bike is a language. You get stuck in this is my ways. You have to refresh constantly until you know this is the way to do it. And then a lot of times, you know the way to do it, but burning it into your head and your muscle memory is a whole nother level. So, you know, when you're talking training especially like a higher level young athlete, like the ones that I genuinely enjoy training, like thinking, okay, like this kid, like I can make a difference in his career. Those are the ones where it's like they dedicate years towards it, and you very rarely see anything that's, you know, like I say, any instant gratification. It's a long, drawn out process. You might take these kids to a national and they crush it all week and they suck when they get there. And they have to wipe it off. And that's where, like, to me, the biggest piece, the hardest part is the mental side. More than anything, you've got to figure out what makes these kids click, what makes them tank as well. Like in Caleb Wood's case, he doesn't like it if other people are hard on him. Like, he rides really, really well pissed off. But you have to find the way to make him mad at himself. But if you make him mad at you, he goes backwards. You have to be hard to get him there. Like, you kind of have to be an asshole. Like, he almost wants to hate you, but he ends up pissed off at himself. And it goes back to a saying that I taught one of my riders a couple of years ago. Like, the only person that you can hate in this industry, like, the only person, when you're on race day, the only person you can hate is yourself. And it sounds crazy when you say it, but, like,
yeah,
like, you are your biggest enemy. You are your biggest advocate. And if anything goes wrong, like, at the end of the day, like, you have to take it on the chin. And a lot of times, like, you end up hating yourself and you're pissed off, and, like, that's where you kind of find that drive, that motivation to take it to that next step. So, you know, finding a way to get across to kids like that and like push them to that next level, because it's there. Like, in a lot of these guys, it's there, it's within them, they just have to find it. And that side's the biggest piece, because again, it's years of building. Like, I can teach that kid a million different ways that this is how you're supposed to do it, but then one day it clicks. One day they put it all together. It's just, man, it's a like I say, a very long, drawn out process.
No, it certainly is. So, like, when you're working with these athletes, do you not find yourself also being able to sort of, like, have those mental resets when you're on the motorcycle? Like, you're harping on Caleb to do this, that, and the other thing, and then you're out there, not only are you executing, but you're also reminding yourself of some of the things that you need to keep in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just yesterday I was supposed to get Janik to regrip. I felt like his regrip was terrible, which puts his body in a bad posture on the bike. And I noticed when I was riding that I had gotten lazy with my hands. I've been working on footwork a lot lately and making sure my toes were in. And obviously with a bad knee, like, that's kind of where a lot of my focus goes, is making sure my knee doesn't twist. But within that, I lost track of some of the other fundamentals that make it to where you can be the difference in good versus great, essentially, is what it boils down to. And my riding was good, but not great. So, yeah, working yesterday, just regrip. Every time I came into a corner, quick regrip. Every time I hit a jump, quick regrip, make sure I was in the right position with my hands. And yeah, it's good to, you see it in somebody else and you realize that it can transfer into your riding as well. And a lot of times it's, man, I've gone over or learned so many things throughout my career that it's good to have those refreshers, because If not, I've already forgot about them. And, you know, even just having Steven sitting by, like, watching for those little things is good. Just having a second eye when things aren't perfect or you need a little reminder.
Fair enough. So if anyone's interested in working with you and Steven at the Shoals over the winter months, we're basically into fall, especially if you're up here in Canada. I think it's a brisk 65 degrees outside today. Where can people get more information? How do they get in contact with you, and what can they expect from working with you?
Well, you can expect that Steven and I are hard asses. We're tough on the kids. We demand perfection. We try to get a lot out of our guys. So some people think we're assholes. I think it works. If you're soft, don't come. Plain and simple. My wife says I'm marketing over here. No, I'm trying to build a like-minded group. I'm trying to build tough kids and you know, people that actually want more out of life, not just another person showing up to a training facility just because mom and dad's paying for it, but a person that comes to us with goals, and hopefully we can help them, you know, reach those goals. But social media is the best way to kind of keep up with what we've got going on, track changes, anything that's new that we're doing. You can obviously reach out through Instagram, Facebook, whatever. But the number associated on the website, on the Instagram, is either going to be mine or my aunt's number, and either way we can get you taken care of. We're starting to book out for the winter months, but still do have some sites available, and it's definitely shaping up to be a really good year as far as our group goes with fast guys for next season.
Perfect. Finish this sentence for me, though, and then we'll get to Steven. In 1 year from now, my racing situation will be
leading the points in two series and ready to wrap it up and go to the beach.
Fair enough. I like
or
it,
maybe
my friend.
Mexico or something. I'll be booking my championship Mexico trip or wherever we decide to go. Where do we like to go? Dominican.
The Dominican, yeah. Perfect. Well, looking forward to that.
She likes Mexico better than that. So.
All right, we're going to Mexico. All right, with that, we'll send things over to Steven Squire. Sound good?
Sounds good.
And now joining us on the podcast, by request by many of his students as well as his boss, I guess is calling us. We're going to get to the bottom of that. Goes by the name of Steven Squire over at the Shoals MX. Steven, how's it going?
I'm doing good, man. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing fantastic. It's Friday. I'm getting some throttle therapy this weekend, as well as watching way too much football. But let's take it to the task at hand. It's about dropping our lap times, and I don't think anyone better to talk to than yourself. You've been at this for a long period of time. Before we get into sort of how you came to working with Stu Baylor over at the Shoals, let's get to know Steven Squire, where this story started. Of course, I'm sure you raced for a long period of time, have now turned yourself over to molding young racers into champions.
Yeah, I mean, I think I, you know, started coaching 13, maybe 14 years ago now, and ran a training facility called SSR for the last 7 years.
Okay.
And then I moved over, or I guess down here, just, you know, right after Loretta's, and now I'm, you know, here full time. But I guess running and operating the daily, you know, the day-to-day operations at a training facility is what my specialty is, between the training, the track maintenance, the scheduling, communicating with parents and riders, you know, reevaluating, going from the races and coming back to the training and how to apply stuff like that. Like, it's, you know, you wear a lot of hats running a training facility, but you have to have a ton of passion for it. And I think that's where, you know, my expertise is the passion side of it.
Certainly, and that obviously comes from a long time spending in the sport, competing, shaping young racers, as well as you are a father. You're a guy who I think that's sometimes a little bit of a hurdle for some trainers. They themselves don't have kids, so they can't really relate to sort of the ins and outs of the ups and downs that certain kids have, and sort of the attitude that they can come into some training sessions. I think that might be a little bit of a leg up for you, given the fact that you are also a father of not one, not two, but is it three?
Yeah, somehow my wife talked me into having three. No, my our youngest just turned one last Tuesday.
Oh, congrats. And
I will say, though, with having kids, there's been different times where I felt a different type of way with the kids and how they, I guess, affect my training. Because when they were younger, my first two, like, it was... They're so sweet and precious. And then you kind of felt bad being as harsh on the younger kids sometimes, because you could see the innocence in them. But then now that they've turned into some creatures and monsters, it's not nearly as hard to be as harsh. But, I love my having the kids involved. And that's honestly one of the big reasons why my wife and I felt like it was a really good move for our, not just me and my career, but us as a family to come down here, because they're involved in racing. My son and my daughter both race and ride. They're on 50, so they're just getting into it. They go to school full time down here and stuff. But, we wanted to make sure that they had an opportunity to do whatever they want to do in this sport and, you know, and got to enjoy it and be around it. And that's, you know, the lifestyle I get to live and the lifestyle my kids get to live by being, you know, running this is, you know, it's a lot of work. They don't see me as much as some, but at the same time, what they do get to do and the value that comes out of that, like, you can't put a dollar amount on it, you know?
No kidding. Yeah. Like the amount of time that you get to spend with your kids, the quality time. You can't put a price on that, whatsoever. So, you yourself as an athlete and also like becoming a trainer, what was sort of that moment where you decided that you'd be able to make a serious impact with some racers? Obviously an accomplished racer in your own right. Like at some point you sort of have to acknowledge that I have a deeper well of knowledge, and not only that, but I can explain it.
I guess, you know, for me, it was really organically. I had a couple really good riders that were chasing their dreams, at a young age, start to come down and spend time with me and basically shadow my training. And one of my first kids that really got heavy in the coaching was Mike Wachowski. And he was on an 85 going on the super mini at the time, and him and another rider that was in moto, basically spent the entire summer with me. And that was kind of my first kickoff into being a coach. And then just over the time, like fairly quickly, from racing and making some money, I bought a house and a truck, and then was injured and found myself having a lot more freedom to coach. So then put more effort into that and was having a really good time, having great success, good feedback. And, you know, without even really sitting back and making any, you know, big decisions, you just, you know, pours fuel on the fire to keep pushing towards that. And then I slowly found myself loving what I was doing and putting more and more into it. And, you know, I guess having good results and good feedback out of it, continued to do that. Then started working for my dad a little bit and worked for him for about 4 years. And while I was part-time training, full-time working for him, and, you know, thankfully he kind of saw everything come in full circle and in a polite way gave me a little bit of an ultimatum and said, you know, son, you're burning the candle at both ends. And, you know, to be fair, you're probably half-assed in both. I think you need to pick and choose what you want to do. And if you want to come and, you know, come over and take over the family business and keep working for me, that's great. But if you want to do this and you enjoy doing it and everything, then, you know, go that route. But whatever you need to do, or whatever you decide to do, you need to pick one. You need to do it to your best. And, you know, my wife and I, we had our daughter, like, on the way. And So it was a risk to take that jump into trying to be a full-time coach and make a living out of it to provide for a family. But at the same time, I was young enough that I knew that if it wasn't working out, that I could bounce back and, you know, find a different career path at the same time. And my dad's career required me to travel a ton. So I wanted to be home during the weeks and different stuff like that. And so I guess that was a big motivation in wanting to become the coach full time. And then the only massive hurdle was being in Indiana where you couldn't do it year round. But we saw, you know, a big clientele base that I had already built and a need in the Midwest for a training facility. So we decided to go ahead and not relocate to a southern state or anything at the time and try to go that route and run a facility or start a facility in Indiana. And we did that with a family that I was already coaching. A kid's Trevor Collip and his family ran the facility together for 7 years and decided to go our separate ways last year. And now, you know, they've moved on and sold the facility because Trevor's turning, or he turned pro last year, and they actually bought the Tyloop Honda team and are working towards, you know, chasing his dreams, continuing that. And it allowed me to, you know, also take this opportunity.
Yes, certainly. And I'm trying to remember the kid's name that I actually had on the podcast, a couple of, maybe about a year ago. He's a young 85 rider. I can't remember his name. I'm actually looking at a picture of him on your Instagram right now. Fly racing rider. Why can I not remember this kid's? I'm like looking straight at it. I can't remember his name.
What's his number?
He's 65.
Dakota Baker.
Dakota Baker. That's right. I had Dakota Baker on this podcast about 8 months ago. Very well spoken young man. And yeah, he was working with you guys for quite some time, and he continues to rise through the ranks himself.
Yeah, him and his family are they're awesome people. His dad and I get along great. He was one of our first full-time riders really at a younger age at the facility in Indiana. And then I'm hoping to get him down here. And as the weather turns up there, I'm pretty sure he's going to be coming down here for the winter to give it a shot. He's kind of just now getting to the age where he could be self-sufficient enough to stay on his own for, yeah, you know, time to time being in between weeks that his dad can get down here. So we're working on the logistics side of getting them something set up down here to where, he can make that transition to basically follow me down here. But I've worked with him for a long time, and honestly, he's a kid that I truly have a lot of big hopes for. He works his butt off. He has a ton of respect for me, and will literally do anything I ask him to do and do it to the best of his abilities. And I do, like I said, have big hopes and dreams for him. And he's already shown that he has the potential, right?
Absolutely, he has. And yeah, like, I think that's a huge sort of moment in a lot of young racers' careers as far as their development, is when they can start to like sort of own more of their own training and be on their own, to spend the amount of time necessary to log the hours behind the controls of a dirt bike that are going to sort of uncover that next level talent, next level skill that gets cultivated by just like the drills. But at the end of the day, it's seat time.
Yeah, and there's no, you know, there's no secret that there's no, I guess what I'm trying to find is, you know, there's nothing else better than seat time. You can't make up for it. But the quality seat time over quantity sometimes with good riders, good track conditions, a structured program, that's where it all comes, you know, full circle to where you have all the pieces of the puzzle to really, you know, make sure that you're ready to go racing.
Certainly. So when it comes to working with racers, what do you find is the biggest challenge working with different age groups? And like, let's be honest, like, there's some kids that are pretty hard nosed. You can have a hard conversation with them, and sometimes you need a different approach. It's not you can't paint everybody with a broad brush. But there is a certain level of intensity that you need to bring to the whole program.
To be honest, I would say the most difficult thing is patience and understanding that it takes a lot longer than what anybody ever feels like it should to get the true results that you're capable of. And it's about the consistency on a program, not, you know, hindering from that and trying to put, you know, stack weeks on and stack months on and honestly stack years on with trusting a program, trusting a coach, and being on the exact same page with, you know, if it's a positive, if it's a positive atmosphere and everything, then staying on that for a longer period of time and really having the consistency there is where I think a lot of people just don't understand how much time it takes to, you know, develop those habits and to continue building on them to reach the full potential. I think, I don't know, it's probably a little bit of just a skill that I was naturally born with, I guess, but I've always been really good at reading people and kind of knowing how to approach them, whether it's with being, and it's not always consistent either, right? But, you know, sometimes you got to be stern, sometimes you got to be caring, be the shoulder to cry on, and then other times you got to be on their ass. And there's always different times for different, you know, circumstances, but at the same time, that's always been pretty natural for me. Like, I don't have to think about it, you know? And then the scheduling and coming up with stuff to make sure that they're getting the right amount of seat time and what's going to bring the most productivity to the whole group and that stuff, like, the people are always normally 100% on board. And then you have the bike set up. That's a crucial thing. Like, it's really difficult to get somebody to a higher level if the bike setup is not, you know, not there. So, but then again, we're all, you know, we're all very aware that a good bike around here is important. So when you tell somebody that they need to improve their bike setup by doing this or doing that, they're normally all ears, right? So you don't fight them on that. So basically the main thing is just trying to get people to understand, don't blow your wad too quick. Like, you have a long window of that you really need to look at the big picture of trying to build a career and not just a year race result or a one race goal or something like that. So you really need to think about the longevity here and the sustainability whenever you're starting something and then continuing on. You've got to keep that in sight. So I would say, I guess to answer that long question, that long worded question, that the biggest thing is just the amount of time it takes and trying to educate the parent and the rider on having the patience on that.
Yeah, it really truly seems to me that I think a lot of riders overestimate what they can get done or the results that can come from one riding session, and they underestimate the amount of progress that can be made in a month, 2 months, 3 months of dedicated chipping away and being consistent with a program that shows in fitness, that shows in bike skill, and just overall rider awareness when you're on the bike. I think that's a huge piece that a lot of kids are missing, and a lot of parents as well.
Yeah, I would say sometimes you get a little bit of a false hope too, because whether you're a youth rider, younger, or a novice rider, those results sometimes come fairly quick at first, because the changes that you're making make big gains. Whereas the faster and more experience you get, the stuff kind of starts to plateau a little bit, and you're not knocking off multiple seconds a lap. You're going for tenths, on a stopwatch. And then sometimes it's just about pure consistency, right? So that's where, the younger and the more novice you are, you get right off the bat all this, rewarded feeling of making these massive gains. And then it starts to slow up. And that's where you really got to learn to trust the process. And also being educated on what you're seeing, I guess, is my job to make sure that you guys can understand why that is slowed up a little bit. But it also comes in waves, right? Like, you could go all week long without making any massive gains or seeing it, but then come, the next week, you could have a really good week and stuff starts to tick. And, you know, fall into place and you're like, oh man, I'm so glad I pushed through all that last week because I'm really seeing the progress this week, or, you know.
Certainly. So when it comes to you, coming on down to the Shoals, what did that situation look like? Stu Baylor is about as hard-nosed a person as I've ever met. He's a businessman. He's as serious as a heart attack. And when it comes to sort of bolstering, his program, both in the woods and on the motocross track, it's something he takes very seriously. How did he end up reaching out and, how'd that all come together?
Well, last fall, the family that I was running the facility with and I went in our separate ways, and Stu was one of the first people to call me and basically just check on me as a friend. But then he was like, you know, if you need a place to go, we would love to have you. And, you know, we figure out what that looks like. And I told him, I said, man, honestly, like, I don't know what I'm doing right now. I'm going to get a job as a full-time equipment operator. I already found a friend of mine that I can go to work for up here in Indiana, and I'm just going to kind of see how stuff goes for a little bit. And, you know, after about 9 months of him continuing to call me and just kind of talk and keep the bug in my ear about doing it, we finally started, I guess, to talk about numbers and take that conversation a little bit more serious. And it started to become, you know, really appealing once I sorted through all the feelings of what I had go down previously. And, you know, I really felt like Stu needed somebody to come in here and treat his facility as their own. And he knew that I'm that guy that would, you know, wear the Shoals on my heart as in my own facility and give it 110% my dedication and effort to be what it's capable of being. And I know for where he's at in his career and what he's got as a team owner and a parent and everything, all the different hats he wears, that the only way for this to be successful, even though it has all the potential in the world, is for somebody like me that one, believes in it, but two, that's willing to do it. So, I don't know, man. I guess after 9 or 10 months of us going back and forth, the talks got a little bit more serious and I started to feel like this was meant to be. And truth be told, like when we had this, the main conversation on the phone, I waited like 3 days to tell my wife because, I just knew she'd be like, all right, we're doing this. And she's got more balls than I do. I'm kind of a little bit hesitant and, you know, calculated. And, I knew that she'd see the potential. She reads people really well and she knows Stu and she knows that this would be a great opportunity. And I was like, gosh, I can't believe we're doing this before I even told her, though. I knew she'd be all in. And like I did, I told her and she'd be like, all right, text him, tell him we'll do it. And I was like, all right, okay, we're doing this. And she said, the only main thing is I want to make sure that we're down there by the start of the school year so our kids can start school down there and not, you know, be changing schools. And my son, he's going in the kindergarten and my daughter's going in the first grade. So they, you know, I don't know, like they're young and we want to make it as easy of a transition as possible. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense. So let me see when school starts. And school started the same week Loretta's did. So it started pretty early. And I was like, all right, so we've got to shift this thing into, you know, high gear here and get this whole move happen. And, you know, we've made it happen to where we are living here on site at the facility in a fifth wheel for the next few months until we can get our house done. So it's a little bit of a sacrifice on her and with the kids to, you know, basically be moving twice and doing all that. But I think it was worth it. And I think it was a great decision. And the amount of momentum, honestly, that we've already started here at the facility since I've been here, I feel like it's, you know, exactly what we wanted to see. And the reaction has been super positive. And the family that I'm working for and stuff between Stu and his aunt and uncle, like they're fantastic, man. I couldn't have asked for a more positive experience coming down here, to be honest.
That is awesome. So, it's so encouraging to hear, like, the guy just absolutely embracing, everything that you do and you wanting to bring that to the Shoals. It's already a fantastic facility. As you continue to work on the Supercross track and the Motocross track, it'll only get that much better. So when it comes to the training itself, on the bike training, how much time is spent on the Motocross track? How much time is spent in the off-road loop? And with some guys coming down to spin some laps in Supercross, Cole Thompson comes to mind. How do you divide your time up between the three?
Well, a lot of it's majority, I would say, for a lot of these guys we do on a moto style track. It was a hybrid turn track that when I got down here, I kind of remodeled to be more of a full blown moto track. And we call it our amateur track at the moment, but it's our irrigated track. And, which means it has a sprinkler system because this time of year is obviously super dry. Anyways, what I was trying to say is the woods riders and the moto riders typically train in a group together.
Okay.
And as the amateur group, and then you have your more pro side or, you know, futures and stuff like that. And then with some younger kids coming, that'll be doing some, the SMX style stuff too, like they'll get some time on it. But depending on what race is coming up is kind of where I go with our schedule and what we're going to spend time on. We generally put in between an hour to 2 hours a day on an hour meter, depending on what we're riding, whether it be woods, moto, or, a little bit of both. And then for the races that are coming up on the GNCC side, we'll do a little bit more that week, getting them acclimated back into the woods. But it's a lot easier to get your brain used to depth perception of speeds and stuff and making those gains and also making the changes on the technique and stuff when you can actually see them a lot of times. So most of your coaching comes on a motocross style track, and then your moto side, as far as like time duration, not moto as in motocross, but like, you know, we'll do our motos a lot for the off-road guys in the woods and stuff. So that way, they're, you know, getting that, I guess, appeal of being in the trees with the trees going by them and everything like that. Like it's, the speed's the same for the most part, but just being, acclimated to being in the woods, there is something to be said about that. So I don't know. There's not really a straight answer. We spend probably most of our time on the moto track, but we have the woods loop here and two other farms that we go to, and any time between a GNCC we'll be basically using up all three of those places also.
Unreal. So what about the off the bike component? I was actually hoping to get in some workouts at the Shoals when I was down there for New Year's, but as soon as Stu turned that place, the gym into a party zone on, I think that was Friday night, all hopes of me getting a workout in after that were squashed. But prior to that, it looked like a very, very capable gym. You've got rowers, you've got bikes, you've got the assault bike, you've got multiple squat racks, basically anything you possibly need to work yourself over, on top of going out and doing a run around the property. There's a lot of ways you can kick your ass and at the Shoals.
Yeah, our daily regimen right now kind of looks like a gym warm-up in the gym. And then we'll ride from about 8 to 1, 8 to 2. And then we do right now majority of our cardio on the bike because we've been riding so much.
Right.
And then our workouts afterwards are pretty much weight stuff. But yeah, the gym here is sick. When I first came down here, I was blown away by how much equipment they have. I mean, there's a lot of money invested into this facility, obviously, but the gym itself goes above and beyond what, you know, I was expecting. And the opportunity there is you can, like you said, you can literally do anything. I think the time of year is right now the reason why we're doing majority of our stuff on the bike because it's so easy to overtrain. But during the winter and stuff like that, you know, obviously a lot of our conditioning will come from in the gym also. It's just I think between one, me just getting down here, and two, the time of year, we've been doing a ton of seat time. And I would say that the riders have been having a blast, but the gains that we've been making are obvious. And, you know, it's hard to go in the gym and do your cycling when we could be out on the track with some insane conditions. So that's where we kind of been focusing on a lot of our time, and then just doing a lot of the weightlifting stuff in the afternoon and, you know, basically preventative maintenance also.
Fair enough. So, and then throughout the entire, the riding sessions, a guy like Cody Groves, is he used more as a class clown, or can he be used at all for demonstration purposes?
Oh man. I can't say he's a class clown because he generally has too much passion and honestly experience to be a clown, because okay. He has a lot okay. of respect for what everybody's doing here. He is obviously a goofball, but at the same time, like, he's not a distraction.
Okay.
So,
okay.
You know, typically, like, I would say my daughter can be the class clown when she's in school because she just wants everybody to laugh at her.
Mm-hmm.
But with Cody, man, he just brings this. An example I would be is like Aaron Plessinger.
Okay.
You know, like, he's going to do every single rep, every single set that you ask him to do to the best of his abilities. But the second he stops, he's going to have this positivity to him that, like, makes you, you know, remember that you're also having a lot of fun in the process, right? And that's where Cody is. Like, he's going to do everything you ask him to do to the best of his abilities. But as soon as he's done, like, he's making you laugh your ass off. I love having people like that around, especially when you have somebody like Cole Thompson that's also here, because that dude's freaking hilarious in his own way. And like, I haven't seen a lot of people that can give Stu as much shit as Cody does, or not Cody, but Cole too. Like, I was absolutely in tears earlier this week with Cole and Stu, and we're on this, on our training track. Okay. And Stu's, or Cole's like, "Stu, didn't you build this track, man?" And Stu's like, "Well, actually, Steven built it." And he's like, "But yeah, right? It's your place, ain't it?" And Stu's like, "Yeah, what are you talking?" He's like, "I just never would have thought that I'd beat you on your own track, man. Like, I don't even know how to take this right now. I'm at a loss for words. Like, I did not wake up this morning mentally prepared to come out and beat you on your own track." And just was laying it on so mm-hmm. thick. And I was dying laughing because, first off, Stu's a hard ass. We all know he's a hard ass, but he's also an insanely talented rider. So he backs up to being a hard ass, right?
Of course.
And so I haven't been around Cole that much. So the whole group was absolutely dying and had a blast. But you know, that's how Cody is too. Like, go out, do your work. But when you're done, or not even when you're done, but in between riding sessions, like, having somebody that brings that fun into it also. That's why I said he's kind of like Aaron Plessinger. Like, he's honestly an asset to have around a lot of times. He really is. Cause he works his butt off. He'll do absolutely anything he tell you to do or ask him to do. He has a heart of gold, but at the same time, he is a loose cannon for sure. No doubt.
No, I've never met someone who can flip a switch like Cody Groves, because he can be absolutely dead serious about putting in 30s or doing his motos, the workout intensity, the riding intensity, and then it seems like as soon as the helmet comes off, he's got a Coors Light in one hand, and he's just being he's like eating a sandwich that's been sitting in the race shop for like 3 weeks, and you're like, "That's going to give you food poisoning." He's like, "I don't even know what that is, son." And you're like, "Wow, okay." And the iron gut that he has just somehow powers through it. And then in the case of Cole Thompson, like, Cole Thompson is a Canadian boy. Like, he may not have grown up in the hockey dressing room, but they all know how to talk shit. Every single Canadian that I know, it's like an inherited thing that you just learn how to carve each other up into a million pieces, and still have a beer with each other afterwards about it. So I have nothing to respect for Cole, and I'm looking forward to seeing what he can make happen at, the playoffs. Cause I believe, Team Solitaire's, competing in the rest of the playoffs. Yes, no?
Yeah, he is.
That's awesome. That is so great to hear.
I know.
Yeah,
that's super sick.
For sure. So go ahead.
I was going to say, I will touch base on one thing about Cody. I will go on record to say that I have not got a chance to work on him with his technique yet because he hasn't been really here since I got here.
Okay.
He was here earlier this summer while I was building the track, and then right after Loretta's, he left to go do the last few outdoors in Baja. So he's supposed to be coming back, I think, next week. But as far as an example goes with your original question, I've got to crack a whip on some of that stuff he's pulling with his elbows down and hanging off the back of the bike and some of this stuff, man. Oh, we're going to go at rounds for sure on it. I can promise you that.
Oh, for sure. Because Cody's got all kinds of speed, but, respectfully to the young Cody Groves, as a photographer or as someone who watches a lot of moto, there's not a lot of great photos of Cody Groves. Does that make sense? Like,
man, if you go to his Baja post, and I'm calling him out harsh right now, but if you go to his Baja post, I think it's his third photo. And I'm pretty sure I sent it to Stu, and I'm like, man, this kid is killing me. But like you said, he's got the speed and he makes it work, but he's definitely not appealing to the eye sometimes, but we'll work on it. It's all a work in progress.
No, I'm dead serious. Like, I'll send you some pictures of me riding. And like, honestly, I'll be completely honest. I'm like a mid pack B rider on my best fucking day. Like, Cody Groves probably has like 10 seconds a lap on me right now. But dollars to donuts, if I don't have more photos of myself that are a little bit like I at least have the body positioning that might lend itself to more speed. That kid's on the ragged edge of what that riding style will allow for. And hey, maybe if you can put some work in with him, he'll be in the motos. No offense there, big guy. We got some work to do.
Yeah, we'll get there, hopefully. But we'll try our best, that's for sure.
How excited are you to work with a kid like Cody or Caleb Wood, who is making his transition from the Super Mini to the 250F? He's been on the 250, like, in practice and training for quite some time. In fact, it's 9 months already. So it's actually crazy to think that he still races and rides a Super Mini on a regular basis as well. It is difficult to go back and forth between those two because, they're different weight. Obviously, one's a two-stroke, one's a four-stroke. Like, it's actually impressive that he's able to be skilled at either one, at both at the very same time. How excited are you to be working with a kid like that?
Well, first off, I think he, after this winter, went back to putting a little bit more time on the Super Mini, especially when he's racing frequently.
Yeah.
Just because of transitioning back and forth and, like, you know, obviously, like you just said, it's so hard. But, dude, that kid already does some stuff on a dirt bike that, you know, like, I have to try to, like, word it to where it doesn't give him too much confidence, because some shit just blows you away on what he's capable of doing. And I guess to answer your question, like, I truly feel like he is capable of being an XC1 champion, you know, and to be, to have the opportunity to help him get there. Like, I'm full steam ahead, man. I'm on board for that.
That is unreal to hear. Love to see it. So before I let you go, on the podcast here, a conversation that I had with Stu yesterday, he had mentioned, and like, you've got balls of steel, to be completely honest, because like, to look into the eyes of the bull that is, Stu Baylor, like the guy will literally stare straight through you if he's not impressed. And by no means would I be calling, Stu Baylor soft in any way. But you were brazen enough, and I honestly, like, this is speaks volumes to how you truly felt about the track prep. Is that the tracks at the Shoals were too prepped, were too much of a highway, were too predictable for these riders to be able to sort of like just get into a comfortable zone and push it. You wanted them more on their toes. You wanted them more so like maybe thrown some different curveballs and get out of that comfort zone. And, straight up, you told Stu Baylor that he was making his riders soft by having the riders ride on such prep tracks that were kind of, I wouldn't say cookie cutter, but they knew what to expect. Maybe dive into that a little bit for me and maybe throw Stu under the bus some more. That'd be fun.
Oh, yeah. No, I said he was spoiling the shit out of him. I was so, like, you know, Stu and I have the same work ethic. Like, we're going to be working. So the thing is what direction are you going in? And for Stu, he was going into, and I was guilty of this for a long time, and I still can be a lot of times, but he was going in the direction to make the track absolutely as badass and epic as possible. But then you go to the races, and, like, it's about having efficient prep and getting it done on a timely manner within schedule to not hinder the race schedule or delay it, you know. And, dude, like, sometimes you'll have a dry section, or sometimes you'll have a section that's just, I don't know, not ideal, right? Well, like, everything was, like, throw a blanket over a perfect track, and that's how it was here with, you know, your irrigated system being reprepped daily and, you know, these picture glamorous ruts that are all no hooks, nothing and everything. And I'm like, dude, like, this ain't real world though. Like, this is training facility world, which is fantasy land, because this shit ain't real. Like, you go to a race and it's fucking blown out, hooks in it. Corners are, you know, some of them are not dry, or some of them are dusty, some of them are overwatered, you know, you have some faces that the water truck can't, and I'm like, quit killing yourself and focusing on, like, having such epic conditions that you're actually doing them a disservice, because then they go to races, and they're, you know, they're like, holy shit, this is like a war zone out here, you know, and that's where I kind of was like, you know, your efforts there, it's just, you're kind of spoiling the shit out of them, you know, like, and I'm not trying to say cut corners or anything, like, we can put our effort somewhere else is all I was saying. But yeah, in my opinion, when I first got here, him and his nephew Trent, man, they love to come out here and tinker on the sprinklers and make sure all the sections are getting hit perfect and re-rip them every day to where it's a slot car track with ruts all the way around it. And, you know, to be honest, like, it's too perfect. That's what I told him. I said, you're spoiling the shit out of these guys. Like, don't get me wrong, it's technical, but at the same time, it's not realistic. And I said, here, let me do it. That's what I said. I got you. But I don't know, man. I go to these races and I spend as much time watching the track develop and watching the track crews as I do is watching the riders, honestly. And my end goal is just to make sure that when we go to races, like, we're as prepared as possible. And if I can have a track that's actually rougher than the racetrack, that's what I'm going after, you know?
Yeah, make racing that much easier. So with that, I ask for some closing statements. If there happens to be a young racer or a young family or a parent that's listening to this podcast, they're interested in getting their kids down to a training facility to put in some work, what does working with you look like?
Oh, it's probably pretty harsh. very blunt and honest. I tell people right off the bat to check their pride when they pull in the entrance. You know, cause honestly, we'll all struggle together. They'll see me struggle. I'll see them struggle, but always know that, like, I have your best interest in heart and I'll only do what I think's right to make, you know, to help you accomplish your goals, whether it's to be the best rider out there or just to get better and try to have some fun or whatever it is. But truly, I think, I bring a ton of passion and enthusiasm to it. So, and the outlook that I have is no matter if you become the next pro rider or not, like, the amount of life skills and work ethic and discipline, time management and stuff that you learn at a facility like this, that's where, you know, it's hard to really say, like, this is all just about riding dirt bikes. You know, this is about building strong, you know, mentally tough people that are ready to go conquer the world, not just ride a dirt bike around a track fast. And I feel like, you know, hopefully when they leave here, whether it be a short stay or a long stay, that they can look back and say that you know, I made a massive impact on their life and taught them a lot of skills more than just riding a dirt bike fast.
Love it, my friend. Steven Squire here on the Big MX Radio podcast. You're down at the Shoals. How do people get in touch if they want to spend some laughs with you and sweat some bullets?
Main thing is social media. Through social media, you can, you know, all of our links and contact information is there. Or I don't know if I should give Tracy's number out over the podcast, but that's how we have everybody sign up and reach out to her directly. Yep. Website, and then from there, get a hold of Tracy, sign up, tell them, you're ready to go and get here quick, because we're definitely in the process of rebuilding, and I don't want to say rebuilding, but building our program and our amateur riders. And honestly, right now, I'm really after a good, strong youth group, man. I want to take a group to these amateur motocross races and off-road races and, you know, start building a long-term relationship with some really, you know, devoted riders.
Love it, my friend. Well, I know you've got a lot of busy stuff to get to the rest of today, continuing to put some finishing touches on that Supercross track so that Cole can put his best foot forward at the SMX playoffs. I thank you so much for making some time for me today.
Yeah, man, I got Christian Janik, too, down here that's doing the last round of the SMX round. So I'll have that Supercross track done today. And, should be getting some photos up of it.
Right on, man. Well, that kid is easy to get good pictures of him. I told him that at Loretta Lynn's. Have yourself a great rest of your day. Do not hang up just yet. But for podcast sake, we're going to cut things off right there.
Welcome to Best 42 in the land. All ages from kids up to grown men. Walk through the gates of the coal miner's daughter to make a point clearer than the creek water. Who's the best? Who's it gonna be? In Hurricane Mills, Tennessee. Can you feel the adrenaline? Dirt flies hypnotized by the wind spin. Hear the crowd, everybody's whistling. Times this 1 week of racing could change your life. Everybody knows this is where it all begins. Do what you gotta do for 20 plus 2 out at the ranch. Golf carts, pit bikes, and rowdy fans. Play the national anthem and everybody stands. Smell the smoke from the two strokes riding by. The 30-second card's on its side.